people chase happiness, but they don't really know to what end. If you're just chasing it for the lack of the negative emotion and that you don't want to have that, then it's not really meaningful. But if you can find something that feels like it's part of your highest value system, something that you truly treasure, you're going to be happy.
Are you ready? Are you sitting down? Season 4 of the Shine On Podcast, absolutely terrific guests. My take on what's happening in the world of divorce. Are the stakes high? You better believe it. The unfiltered and real take on what divorce is like from the absolute best professionals. Life, love, marriage, divorce, relationships, finances. Topics that far too often many people shy away from. But not here on the Shine On Podcast. It's episode 75 of the Shine On Podcast. I'm Evan Shine. As we record this episode, the sun in New York is shining outside my Midtown Manhattan office overlooking Bryant Park, where I got to tell you what, people are everywhere on this absolutely glorious day, eating lunch, having coffee, or just hanging out. So wherever you are today listening to the podcast, I hope the sun is shining for you as well. Producer Dave, you got that summer vibe going. You have, I can see, you've officially turned the page from long sleeves and pants to short sleeves and shorts.
That's right. The sweaters have been tucked away, although I'm in New England, so I might need them tomorrow. But for now, sunny day, happy. 70 degrees today where I'm sitting, so nothing wrong with that.
It's a beautiful thing, and I'm feeling great about the weather today. And how could I not be? And talking about great, Dave, we have an absolutely fantastic featured guest on the podcast coming up shortly and after the docket segment. I am joined by Dr. Judy Ho, who is a clinical and forensic neuropsychologist. She's also a professor, host of the Supercharged Life podcast, and published author. Her brand new book, The New Rules of Attachment, is out now. You should run. I mean, run. You know what, Dave? I'm going to change that. You should sprint to your local bookstore, or as soon as you finish listening to the podcast, click on Amazon.com, pick up a copy of this book and also her previous book, which is also a must read, Stop Self-Sabotage. And Dave, let me ask you, are you fired up for the docket?
I am, man. I got my finger on the trigger if you're ready, Evan.
Dave, let's do it.
All right.
And now, let's see what's on the docket.
We will start by hearing from our friends from the New York Times.
Item one.
Headline in the Times reads as follows. How to show up for a friend getting divorced. This article gives some advice and says the end of a marriage can be incredibly isolating, but small gestures from loved ones can provide some relief. Your thoughts on this?
Dave, I love this, and this is a must read. Why? Because I find so many people, they get it wrong when their friends are going through a divorce and splitting up. People want to help their friends. I truly believe that people want to be there to support someone going through a tough time, a rocky time, a divorce. But the question is, are you doing it the right way? Are you showing up for your friend who is going through one of the most difficult times in his or her life the right way? The best way. And divorce can be isolating. Talking about it, as the article notes, can make you feel self-conscious. As Dr. Jeffrey Gardier, a psychologist, quoted in the article notes, it completely changes your life's direction. And of all the tips and things mentioned that experts suggest can help a loved one going through a divorce, the one I love the most is the vent walk. I'm going to start going on vent walks. I love this concept, that idea of a vent walk. And Dave, let me ask you, because you live this, right? You've been through the divorce process. You're divorced. You've been open. You've talked about it. As you look back, give us the things those closest to you did to support you that people got right, and the things people said or did where you were like, wow, I can't believe you said that, and you got it totally wrong.
Yeah. Well, I'll give you a rapid fire top five from me. Number one, stay in contact with the person in some kind of consistent way. In other words, even if it's just dropping a text saying, hey, what's up? Just thinking about you. Hope you're doing well. Even something as minor as that, you do that even maybe once a week, because it's a long process. It's a long period of acclimation getting to used to being a single person when you haven't been for so long. Just hearing from a person, just that little gesture will do well. Second, I would say keep the status quo as best you can. In other words, if you have gotten together with this friend, even if you get together with as couples in the past, in the future, if you're still friends with the person, keep doing those things. Keep making those invites. Keep having them over. Don't assume that their whole world is upside down because they want some sense of normalcy. They didn't get divorced from you, friend. They got divorced from their spouse. So keep the status quo. Little things like helping people, like if someone's moving, if you're so inclined, if you're brave enough, offer them to help them move. Offer to help them with the boring things in life. Don't necessarily think of doing some big gesture or throwing like a party for them or inviting them out to some lavish dinner or something. Offer to go over and help them do the bills one day. Maybe they're not used to doing the bills, or help them move a couch or something. Those are little things that people will appreciate. No pity. Don't, you talked about, Evan, what you should say and what you shouldn't say. Don't come at a person going, I'm so sorry. Oh, it was such a long, wonderful, we loved you guys so much as a couple. Oh, it's so sad. It's so sad. In fact, don't say I'm sorry at all, because the person's trying to be optimistic, I'm sure. And as has been said many times in the past, no good marriage ends in divorce. So there's a bright side to the marriage ending, and it's the person getting along with their life. And then finally, try to be thoughtful. If your friend is into, I don't know, scrapbooking, get him a new scrapbook. Yeah, I was thinking about you. I know you like the scrapbook. Or someone like me, Dave, I know you like your bourbon. Stop by. I got you a bottle of bourbon. That applies to this day, Evan, if anyone wants to stop by.
I was going to say, I think you're also looking for Red Sox tickets too, still.
Those would be welcome as well.
But Dave, I'm listening to you, and I think you're making some really great points. I love the top five. And as you're talking and you're looking at it, obviously, from your perspective, and as you went through this, what about the idea, should people and friends and loved ones ask the person who's going through a divorce, hey, what can I do to be there for you, right? Because people do things based on what they think someone might like, what they think that other person might need. What about simply asking the person, your friend who's going through it, and say, hey, I know this is a really tough time. I'm here for you. Any way I can be. What do you need? What could I do?
I think it's great. And not that many people asked me that. I mean, people were supportive, of course. And sometimes people that I thought would be supportive weren't, and the reverse of others. So you never know what to expect. But for sure, asking. Now, you should ask that question. And then I just say, just take the answer in stride, because the person might not know the answer to that question right away. The person might be like, I don't know, man, it's a mess. But then at least you've asked, and you can ask again in a couple of weeks. Check in. Just checking in. Anything I can do for you? Help you out? I got some time on my hands. Take you out for a beer. Take you out for a coffee. And so that's a great point, Evan. More people should do that.
And the other thing I want to ask you about, Dave, because the article talks about it, and I'm curious on your thoughts. The article mentions, in terms of support that someone going through a divorce is receiving, that if you're the friend, if you're the family, you should be careful not to be critical of that person's ex-spouse. And the reason given in the article is because you don't want that person going through a divorce to feel worse, to feel badly, as if the entire marriage was a mistake and that they should have seen the red flags, or they shouldn't have been married in the first place. And that person now is trying to move on, and focusing on the negative and being critical of that person's spouse actually could do more harm and prevent the person from moving forward. So what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I'd agree. Stay positive, because you actually don't know how the person necessarily feels about their soon-to-be ex-spouse. They, you know, and it might differ on a different day. It might be a completely different feeling. But just because a person is getting divorced doesn't mean they're interested in hearing the most horrible things about their ex-spouse. And you're right, it might make them feel worse. It's like, I can't believe you were married to that person for this long. It's like, what? You're saying I wasted the last 10, 15, 20 years of my life? So I'd tread carefully there. I'd stay silent on it and just sort of be supportive for the person. If the person wants to vent about their ex-spouse, then let them vent. Do the vent walk. Do the vent walk.
And Dave, I know we talked about it before. Look, I can talk all day about this topic because I think there's so many great points in this article. What about if you and your wife at the time had mutual friends? Was there ever an issue post-divorce, almost like who gets to keep Dave, who gets to keep Dave's wife? Like, how do you balance when in other couples, both spouses have relationships with both you and your wife? Did that come up?
It certainly comes up. And you when you get divorced, you have to realize that part of the process is you are probably going to lose some friends. It's just, it is what it is. If the person was closer to your spouse. One thing that one moment I noticed in divorce was I came across a friend of my ex-wife's, very sweet person. Her name was Susan. Her name still is Susan, but she was definitely closer to my wife. And she told me that she said, "I hope you're doing well." And I said, "Yeah, I'm doing okay." She said, "I just got to tell you, I bumped into so-and-so and they said, well, which team are you on, Team Ann or Team Dave?" And this person, to her credit, she said, "Listen, it's a sad thing. I'm closer to Ann, but I'm not on team anybody. Like, why do we have to do that?" And I thought that was a nice thing for her to tell me that, you know, she's definitely going to stay closer to my ex-spouse, but doesn't mean she can't be respectful and nice and treat. Why are you going to treat somebody completely differently than you did years prior?
Well, and to that point, we're in a world society where divorce is less taboo, obviously, than it was many, many, many years ago. This whole team that you were referencing, why can't people be friends with both of you and do things with both of you? Why is it I need to pick one? Why does that mentality still exist?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you want to be loyal to your friends. And so I can see how you would go to someone and say, "I just want you to know I'm friends with you and your spouse. I'm not going to burn your ex-spouse in effigy or anything, but you know, my loyalty is to you. What can I do for you?" I think that's okay. If you've like shut someone completely off, you're going to bump into them again. And why wouldn't you want to be at least on good terms with someone who you've been on terms with so long in the past? Why does that all have to change? It doesn't have to.
Yeah, that's a good point. And the article doesn't talk about this, but as you were talking and just thinking about the conversation, are there people who you had expected to reach out to you and be there much more than they were to support you? And as a result of them not being there during this tough time, during the divorce, the time after the divorce, your friendship with those individuals sort of felt there was a fallout.
Yeah, I think that definitely happens. And years later, I would look back and say, "Hey, you know what? I really miss that person. That's too bad that I don't see that person anymore. And maybe that is a person that could have reached out to me and didn't." But I tried to stay on the positive tip and I tried not to sort of wallow in self-pity. In other words, if I was the friends with the person in the past, I want to maintain that friendship. I can be the one to reach out. Like I can do that. And if they're distant and cold to me, then all right, God bless. Good luck in your life and everything. But at some point you have to realize that life isn't all just about you. And that person's got other things going on in their life. And maybe they didn't really intend to shun you, and maybe they're just busy, and maybe you would still enjoy that friendship. So it's, to me, it's once you get done with the initial healing, you do get to pick your friends. You know, you can, as we know, Evan, you can pick your nose and you can pick your friends. You just can't pick your friend's noses. That's the only thing.
That is true. Dave, I got to tell you, this docket, this one article was that good. So much information. You know what? Let's get right into the Ask Evan.
All right, let's do it.
Ask Evan.
Ask Evan.
Ask Evan.
This edition of Ask Evan, where we hear from you, the listeners, features a note from Rich in Albany. And Rich writes the following. "Dear Evan, is it true that you hire one kind of lawyer if you are looking at a contentious divorce and another kind if it is amicable? And what if I'm not sure whether it's going to be a battle or not? What say you, counselor?"
Rich, I got to tell you, I love this question. This could be a whole podcast episode in itself, but look, I've said it before, I'll say it again. Hiring the right divorce attorney is one of the biggest decisions you can make. So educate yourself. Do your research. Hire an attorney you feel comfortable with and that you believe is the right fit for you. Now, when you say amicable, it's hard to exactly know if you're referring to mediation or the collaborative process as opposed to litigation and divorcing in the court system. But if you are referring to mediation or collaborative law, find an attorney who does those things, right? Don't hire a litigator to be your mediator. So any attorney you hire is going to be an extension of you. That attorney is going to set the tone for your divorce, and the decision on who you hire is going to send a message to your soon-to-be ex and how you want the process to go. So hire smartly and with these tips in mind.
That's another edition of Ask Evan. If you want to submit a question for Evan to answer on the podcast, email producer Dave at david@pod617.com.
Our featured guest this week on the Shine Up podcast is Dr. Judy Ho. She is a triple board certified and licensed clinical and forensic neuropsychologist, a professor at Pepperdine University, host of the Supercharged Life podcast, and published author. Dr. Judy serves as an expert witness in legal cases and is a sought-after legal commentator. Dr. Judy, it's an absolute pleasure to have you on the podcast. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, thank you, Evan. So this is actually going to be the most fun part of my day, which is hanging out with an amazing attorney. I don't know if you know this about me, but most of my closest friends from college all turned out to be attorneys. And because I'm doing forensic expert witness work now, I talk to attorneys all day, every day for hours at a time. And so I actually didn't have any other attorneys I'm talking to today. So you are going to be like my shining beacon for today.
Fantastic. I love that. I can tell you that nobody else in my day so far has called me that shining beacon. So I'm thrilled to have you on. We are going to have some fun. And Dr. Judy, you have a new book out, which is absolutely tremendous. And the book is called The New Rules of Attachment, How to Heal Your Relationships, Reparent Your Inner Child, and Secure Your Life Vision. And so I want to start by asking you, what was the experience of writing the book like? And what was your process from the beginning stages when you first identified the topic of attachment theory was going to be the focus through the final moments when you saw your book out there on the bookshelves?
Yeah, this is a great series of questions. So I decided to write about attachment because I felt like this was a universal concept that was affecting people that perhaps people don't really readily explore or truly understand it for what it is. A lot of the attachment literature that is out in pop media really focuses on attachment's relationship and impact to your intimate partnerships. And obviously that's one extension of how attachment can affect you, but there's so many others. And most of all, it affects your belief in yourself. It affects what you think about yourself, your self-concept, your self-esteem. And of course that then radiates out to all kinds of things from your career to your friendships, your family relationships, to your romantic relationships. So once I identified the topic and I got a publisher to buy into it, I was going to write the rest of the book. So, you know, for me, I think writing, it has to be a balance of you want to write more when you're feeling inspired to do it, but also you just have to have a structure for writing. So I made sure that every single day I set aside some time to write, and I try to work on small sections and pieces at a time. And my vision for this book was that I really wanted people to be able to walk away with practical strategies that are science-based, but are digestible, so that if you decided to not do this work with the help of a mental health professional, you would be able to understand the work and be able to implement it yourself without being totally overwhelmed. So I really wanted these practical takeaways, but I also really wanted to make sure that the foundation was there. So trying to explain the attachment wounds and how it's affecting people in different ways through some of my de-identified client conglomerate stories, that was an important piece of it too, so that people can see the narrative and see how it applies into their lives too.
I love that. Tell us how your work challenges the traditional attachment theories.
Right. So aside from the first thing that I mentioned, which is that I only usually see attachment as applied to romantic relationships, I also think that people sometimes feel that attachment is sort of a categorical thing, that okay, I'm identifying as this attachment style or that attachment style, and this is what applies to me. And I think most people actually show combinations of attachment styles. So some people might say, well, I'm a little bit anxious and I'm also a little bit avoidant. And sometimes they'll see that happening in the different spheres of their lives, like I feel like I'm more avoidantly attached in romantic relationships, but maybe in my career, I'm more anxiously attached. That's very common. And it's because all of us have different levels of influences from primary caregivers who are adults in our lives. And when we were little children, they were taking care of us. There's more than one person that you grew up around. And so you might develop different attachment styles for that reason. I also think that attachment styles, when people talk about it, it's sort of like, I identify with this. It's almost like a personality trait and I'm just have to deal with it for the rest of my life. And that's absolutely not true. I think that attachment can be healed at any age and stage. And you don't even need to have your family get into the work with you if they're not ready to or don't want to or not available to do so. You can heal attachment on your own, no matter how old you are and no matter what stage of life you're in. And then another piece that I think is also contrasting what I see out there in terms of the pop culture information is that people think of disorganized attachment, which is one of the three insecure types, as the worst type. It's like, you're not going to recover. It's terrible. People associate it with personality disorders. And I just think that there's a lot of misconceptions about it. And I think the disorganized type is the least understood. So I really try to shine a light on what it really is in my book. And also, again, that message of, hey, there's hope. Even if you think you have the disorganized attachment style, you can absolutely heal from that and be able to channel the life of somebody who's securely attached. You can find that for yourself.
And Judy, you touched on it, but tell us more about how our childhood experiences really shape attachment styles in adulthood.
Yeah, so our earliest bonds with the people in our lives that are primarily tasked with taking care of us and meeting our needs on a constant basis, those first bonds are your attachment bonds. Those are crucial for our survival. We are born basically helpless little babies. That's why human babies are cute. We have to be cute so that we can entice these adults to stay around us, even though we cry all the time and we poop our diaper and all of that stuff, right? So it's important that we keep adults around us because for those first few years of life, especially, we're pretty much not able to survive on our own. But because of the necessity of that relationship, we also develop a lot of ideas and beliefs about how the world works. And most of all, what we think about ourselves from those early interactions. And so it starts forming at a very early age. And if it's like a one-off or a two-off, you might not cement that into your memory. But once there's a pattern that repeats over time, it starts to create an emotional imprint. And that emotional imprint then goes into our foundational self-talk, the way that we talk to ourselves, the way that we think whether or not we believe good outcomes are supposed to happen to us, and whether or not symbiotic relationships with other people are possible.
The next question I was debating as I was prepping, obviously, for this conversation, I'm going to ask, although I'm almost hesitant to, because I know the moment we hang up on the podcast, I'm going to take whatever you say and I'm going to do it. But if I want to know my attachment style, how can I figure it out?
Well, I have a quiz. If you like quizzes, Evan, we can take this quiz, but it's basically going to be a quiz that you can take in about 10, 15 minutes, ask you some questions. It's available on my website, so you can grab that for free. But essentially, that's one way to find out what your attachment style is. Another way to find out what your attachment style is, if you're like, I'm not really a quiz person, show me a different way to do it, is that I have found that each attachment style comes with its own quintessential self-talk. It's like this kind of statements that you say to yourself that tend to be common among people who identify with this type. And so you can also read the statements and think about, well, which one feels the most true to me? And as I mentioned before, it could be a combined type. So you could find that, well, a couple of the statements apply to me in the disorganized attachment, but also some apply to me for the avoidant attachment. And that's another way that you can find out what attachment style you are.
That's not too bad. I haven't taken a quiz since for the past 20 something years, since I think high school, but you know what?
Your bar exam.
The bar exam, which I would have liked if that was a quiz as opposed to
the three day.
I think it might've even been 4 days point when I took it. And if I never take another bar exam, I'm good.
You're
with
okay
that.
With that?
Yes.
Yeah. So, you know, it wasn't even as bad as for us as psychologists. I think our exam was one day. So you guys are going through the ringer a lot more than we are.
Yeah, no, it was definitely a ringer and not a fun process by any stretch of the imagination.
No.
So speaking of success stories, and I love a good client success story, share a success story with us from individuals who you've worked with, who have benefited from the work that you do with them, whether it's the quiz, whether it's the counseling, whether it's a moment in their work with you where they discover something, they figure something out that they perhaps did not know before?
Yeah, great question. Well, one case specifically comes to mind, which is one of my most overachieving clients who has just created just a huge business for himself. I mean, really, it was like pulling himself up from his bootstraps. There was absolutely no help that he received from anybody else. He really just figured this out for himself and really admired within his community because he's really happy to mentor people, always ready to jump on any work tasks or collaborations with people. I mean, he's really, really great with all of that. But it was at the expense of any kind of personal relationship. So he kind of shows up at this hero for people who are his casual acquaintances, but then for this set of longer lasting relationships, like members of his family or his romantic partners, really wasn't all that available. But of course, his fallback was always, well, I have so much to do. I have this mentorship. I got to go to this nonprofit. I have my own business to run. So there's always a really good reason for him to not be available to these people who he's supposed to have the closest relationships with in his life. But also they couldn't really argue with him because he's so purposeful and the things that he's doing is helping people. So really, he did not come to see me at his own insistence. He felt like his life was fine. Of course, it was his partner that said, can you please go to couples counseling with me? I don't know if we have a future anymore. And he kind of wrestled with that, like, okay, well, maybe I'll just get out of this relationship, bail. But I think he cared enough about her that he said, I'm going to come in. So comes in. Most of our first few sessions were really just talking about how busy he was and how all these people make demands on him, et cetera. And he just doesn't understand because he feels like he's showing up in the best way that he can. And really, it was through our next sessions where we started to unpack a little bit about his childhood and how he really felt like he was parentified at a very young age and that essentially people around him were pretty distracted. So the way that he got them to pay attention to him was to essentially be the star child. There were four other kids in the family. They each kind of had their own different personalities. And his was always like, I'm going to unite the family. Everyone's coming to my soccer game. Everybody's coming to my speech and debate presentation, right? And so he kind of learned that this was one of the ways that he can essentially get some kind of support and attention from others. But also it increasingly just became this belief that people aren't going to really be around anyway. So like, why invest in them? I can invest in other things that are going to come to fruition. Relationships don't really do that. So it makes sense that whenever he's stressed, he basically just isolates himself and just starts working. It's like he's becomes a complete workaholic. So it's a form of avoidance and a form of escape. And we had talked about this almost as a type of addiction process. It's like, well, why do people gamble? Why do people spend 20 hours a day playing video games or using too much alcohol or substances? It's to temporarily escape whatever emotional distress they're actually feeling. And so like kind of connecting those dots there, understanding from his childhood why he developed these ideas that people aren't so trustworthy. So like invest in things rather than people. It helped him to get enough insight so that while his behaviors didn't change overnight, he was able to start slowly letting certain key people into his life a little bit more. And it was kind of a very, very gradual process of, okay, you have a problem. Instead of just going into your own room and not coming out for 2 days and working on a new project, like ask somebody to help you. You like learn to delegate a little bit, even if it's not the most important task that you have, or just share that you're feeling stressed. It's okay to say that you're stressed. You're a human being. Like that's a very easy emotion to identify with, even if you're a top performing person. So start with that. And then maybe later you can talk about more vulnerable emotions like sadness or anger. So it was definitely a process, but it definitely helped him to at least achieve some kind of a balance in his life. It wasn't like all of a sudden he's this huge vulnerable person, wants to talk about emotions all the time, but he became a lot easier, I think, to deal with for his family. And I think he got a lot more enjoyment out of his relationships too.
So take us inside your mind when the client has that breakthrough moment, when the proverbial light bulb goes off. What's it like on your side of it when you have that moment with the client?
Well, it feels good for me when I know that something we're doing is resonating and making a difference. I don't really have too much ego attached to it. Like if they say I'm completely off base, like I'm cool. Like we can just go back to the drawing board. I mean, there's no reason. And that's why I have some people pleasing clients too, those who identify as anxiously attached. I'm like, please do not tell me, oh, you're right. If I'm not right. Like if I'm not right, that's okay. Like I might be taking a stab in the dark, but they have a hard time doing that. Right. And so sometimes we can spend two sessions on something before they finally say, yeah, actually, that's not really too descriptive of me. I'm like, well, what did we just do for the last two sessions? So I don't have too much ego attached to it. I want it to be helpful for them. So if they're saying, yeah, this resonates, or yes, this lands, it makes me feel good that they might have gotten some insight that will move their lives forward. So to me, it is joyous for me when I see them making the connections. Like if I make it for them, it doesn't really count either, because they can kind of just be listening and saying, oh, okay. But it's really more important that they make that connection themselves somehow. Like, oh, okay, well now this makes sense. And maybe this is why I do these things.
Well, it's a beautiful thing when the pieces of the puzzle connect.
Yeah, exactly. That's how I feel. I think that's really my role, right? It's to just like guide them to connect the pieces as opposed to me connecting it for them. But that's a funny puzzle analogy, because I'm actually terrible at puzzles in real life. So I would not be that person. But yes, metaphorically, that's who I am in therapy.
You know what? If it makes you feel any better, I was terrible at puzzles as well until I started doing them with my kids. And now I'm pretty good. It's amazing, you know? When you have to be good. You can't have your four-year-old look at you and say, Daddy, you're pretty bad at this. So I good thing to bond over.
Well, maybe I just have to keep pushing at it, because my two-year-old is officially better at puzzles than I am. So maybe I just need to practice more. But it's good that you're beating your kids. That's great.
Exactly. No, I don't let them win in my household. But
right?
Dude, going back to attachment theory for a moment, can you discuss the connection between attachment style and mental health issues like anxiety and depression?
Yeah, for sure. I think because attachment is so foundational to who you are and whether you believe you're worthy and whether you think that other people love you and care about you just as you are, it's going to create mental health concerns like anxiety and worrying about what other people think and worrying if you're good enough, to depression of the sadness when you feel like you've made a mistake and beating yourself up more than you need to, thinking that no matter what you do, people are going to abandon or reject or disappoint you. So what's the point? Those kinds of things lead to feelings of hopelessness. And that essentially is a conduit to depression symptoms.
How can understanding attachment styles improve communication and conflict resolution in relationships, or possibly save or help save a marriage that may otherwise be headed for divorce?
Well, I think attachment styles are kind of very much related to communication styles. Depending on your attachment style, you're going to have certain preferred ways of communication, and you're also going to have certain types of communication that will trigger you. So if you are somebody who has that knowledge of, hey, you know what, I'm obviously working on it, but as of this moment, I'm still kind of operating as an anxiously attached person, generally, your communication preferences are going to be, I really need my words of affirmation, right? Like if to use some of the five love languages parallels, like I really need people to affirm me all the time. I need to be validated all the time. That doesn't mean that people should overdo it, because that might actually make it worse. It's almost like enabling the person to keep acting in this way. But it's like there's a balance of, before we get into any critiques, I might need you to soften the blow for me by telling me something that you appreciate about me first, because then I'm actually going to listen, right? Because if you're going to start the conversation by what's wrong, then the person who is anxiously attached is not going to receive that well. They're going to be on the defense, and they're going to be either acting in super clingy ways, like asking you for affirmation when you're trying to get the problem solved, or they're just going to shut down and not even listen to you. And so I think that those are the kinds of things that you want to watch out for, is if we can just understand the attachment style of ourselves and the person we're talking to, knowing what each of your preferences are and being open about it, we can all communicate better. And like you said, potentially even save a marriage, because marriage problems, 99.9% of them have to do with some aspect of communication. So if you're able to work out some of those communication conflicts, you might have a chance at saving a long-term relationship.
And Judy, your book out, The New Rules of Attachment, How to Heal Your Relationships, Reparent Your Inner Child, and Secure Your Life Vision is fantastic, but you're no stranger to the book world. In fact, you wrote a book, Stop Self-Sabotage, which really focused on the concept of self-sabotage. And one of the culprits you identify is social media. So could you explain this phenomenon and how you suggest people use social media meaningfully and not destructively?
Yeah, social media is just ripe for direct comparison, like so quickly in the moment, right? You're not waiting now, like in the old days. It's like you're waiting for the newspaper to publish the news about something that happens in your community. Now it's like you just open X or Facebook or Instagram, yep. and all of a sudden there's these shiny new posts of by people totally curated, right? These highlight reels of other people's lives. Like, look at me, I'm so beautiful and I'm having so much fun and my family's perfect. And oh my gosh, like that humble gratitude, but it's a brag, right? Like, so blessed today because, and then it's like, okay, you're just bragging now. Like, what is going on? But it's just so easy to make that comparison so quickly. And then I think that because you're comparing your life to someone's highlight reel, I mean, they're not showing when they spilled coffee on their shirt in the morning or like
of course not.
The argument they had with their spouse right before they posted this beautiful photo of their perfect family, right? And so you're coming from a place of reality, like life as me, every single moment of it. And then looking at someone's highlight reel and you're like, of course, I'm not going to measure up. Or like, why am I not happier? Right. And so this kind of self-talk will just creep up on you so quickly. And the worst part is when you're consuming social media, you're rarely doing it with somebody next to you to check your reality. Like you're doing it on your own. Sometimes in the darkness of your room as you're trying to fall asleep, but can't. And there's nobody to rescue you from your own negative thinking.
Yeah.
And so you can just get into a huge downward spiral. And that's what causes self-sabotage because everything starts with your thoughts. Everything starts with your perceptions about something. And those perceptions can then lead to negative feelings and then self-sabotaging actions, which of course then double back onto your thoughts to say, haha, see, I knew it. I'm an idiot or I'm a loser. And then it just kind of cascades from there. And so the way to meaningfully consume social media, obviously it's not going away. So telling someone to never use social media is just probably unrealistic for most people. It's really about if you're going to use social media, keeping that in mind that you're looking at someone's highlight reel and that there are literally just apps, thousands of apps out there that will make you look like you just walked off of a runway in like 2 seconds. I mean, it's just crazy. Like how crazy the photoshopping is nowadays. It takes time to do it, but people will do it, right? And also the second piece is most people passively scroll through social media. It's kind of like doom scrolling. So you have to interact. Like if you stop to actually write a comment that's meaningful, or like you see social media and you see somebody announcing something positive in their life, and instead of just like scrolling through, pick up the phone and text or call them and say, congratulations, I saw that this happened. That's awesome. And actually having a real conversation with someone you care about. Those are some of the things that we can remind ourselves of. And then of course, is just not having social media all the time. Like it's such clickbait, right? You see this little pop up on your phone. Oh, so-and-so message you. You're like, I have to look at it now. Do you have to look at it now? You also can turn off those notifications, which I have off on my phone. And so I think really making sure that you set up a good structure for yourself and maybe considering taking some social media breaks too. Like, okay, on Sunday, I'm just not going to look at social media. There's no reason that I have to look at it. I'm not really missing that much. I mean, the fear of missing out, that FOMO is so real for all ages. It's not just younger people. I see it in older people. I recently had a client who's like in her 70s and her adult kids who are in their 40s are coming to me saying, can you please get our mom off of Facebook? I mean, she's constantly on it. I was like, well, that's interesting.
I believe it. I mean, I've heard similar things. I mean, even clients of mine in their 50s, 60s, I mean, people who are going through the gray divorce and how they're meeting other people, finding other relationships. I mean, these are people, especially during the pandemic, where isolation, loneliness was so prevalent for so many people. Social media was an outlet. It was an escape. Yeah. It was a way for people to connect when in-person interaction was non-existent.
Exactly. And it makes sense. I mean, and obviously it serves a purpose in that way. And I think that some people will say some of my closest friends are on social media. That's how I discovered them. That's all understandable, but it's really about having some balance and not getting to a point where you feel like if you don't check your phone every few minutes that you might have an anxiety attack. I mean, I'm hearing that people feel that way now and there'll be fights that like literally ensue in families where it's like, taking away the person's phone, the person getting super aggressive and angry about it. It's like, well, that's when you know it's a problem. So like finding some way to consume it more responsibly and with structure, and then also making time for in real life conversations, because that's still how we're built evolutionarily. We just need to be in the presence of another person and like have just the hormones like of like love and caring and connection. Like they happen differently when you're in person with somebody as opposed to constantly being online with somebody.
No, we're sharing a brain on that. And Judy, you've written that breaking New Year's resolutions, it's an example of self-sabotage. Yeah. So let me ask you, did you make New Year's resolutions this year? And if so, how are you doing with them?
I have not made New Year resolutions in at least a decade. Wow. And I think it's because of the fact that...
Tell us why.
Yeah, I think that it's like a huge trap. I think that making New Year resolutions, it's kind of like you make this like arbitrary demarcation of like, okay, this is a new year. And like, somehow you're supposed to never mess up again. It's like, no, you're going to make mistakes. You should be expecting yourself to make mistakes. But I think that there's something about the new year that's like, well, this is a brand new year, 2024, like everything's going to be different this year. And then they have their one misstep, which of course everybody does probably in the first couple of weeks. And it's like, forget it. And then they throw out the whole baby with the bathwater. Like if I couldn't do it on New Year's, how could I do it later? It's like, no, just make the goals that you want to make whenever you want to make them. And then also really recognizing that for most things, for behavior change to actually happen and start to feel more naturalistic, for most people, it takes 4 to 6 weeks. So it's going to feel hard for about a month and a half before it starts to feel easier. So also just, you know, really adjust your expectations, right? People think, oh, because I have all the motivation in the world right now, it's going to feel easy. If it was that easy, then you would have done it a long time ago. And also whatever pattern you're trying to break now or create, there was a pattern of years and months before that where you didn't have this particular activity, right? So you have to just remember that for yourself too. And so I just tend to make goals as I go along. Like I want to do this by March. I want to do this by April. I don't really demarcate my goals by the new year.
No, I love that. And Judy, let me ask you, what was the experience of writing the first book, Stop Self-Sabotage? What was that like in comparison to the new book that you have out?
Yeah, I think the first book was interesting because I kind of didn't really necessarily know what I was stepping into. No. So it was a lot of work. It was a lot of work, especially because my research is, I really want to make sure my research is within the books too, that like it's backed up by sources. Like, so it's not just kind of me writing a memoir, right? It's nothing like that. So it's a little bit of a different process because it's really brain intensive. But I don't know. It kind of feels a little bit like how probably most people feel after they give birth to a child and it was pretty painful, but then like they do it again. It's like, it was painful, but it was rewarding, right? So then like you do it again and then you go through the pain again, except this time I was actually raising a newborn while I was writing this book. So that was so much more exhausting than I thought it was going to be. I was basically writing like a grad student, sometimes writing at 3 a.m. because that's when it was quiet. So I think that the first thing was like no expectations. The second time I was like, I think I know what I'm walking into. And of course you still don't. So I guess like the parallel is you never really truly know the process until you're in it, because obviously I was raising a newborn while writing the new rules of attachment. And that was also interesting because it's like, oh, attachment, like my baby, like now it's not just my professional knowledge base. Sure. It's like, I'm also trying to create secure attachment in my baby. So a lot of that was going on, like art paralleling life and vice versa.
No, that had to be a fascinating and interesting time on both fronts, the personal front and also the professional front.
Yeah. It was a lot of fun and it was a great rewarding time. Although as I'm getting older, I realize that I just don't have the capacity anymore to stay up until 3 o'clock and be in my right mind. So sometimes I'll like write until 3 and I'm like, awesome, I got so much done. Then I'll read in the morning. I'm like, this is absolute crap. Like have to just ditch all 20 pages I wrote at 2 a.m. and restart.
That's funny. And Judy, I want to go from writing a book to testifying in a courtroom as an expert and that experience. And look, as an attorney, and I run our firm's litigation department, I love having an expert on the stand, the prep, the moment, the flow, whether it's a favorable expert or not so favorable expert, and you're cross-examining a witness. And so what's it like for you as an expert witness? And give us a mistake or two that you've seen attorneys make when working with them, either in or out of the courtroom.
Yeah, great question. So I really like doing expert witness work. I know that that's not what everybody else feels. A lot of my colleagues who are psychologists are like, I would not touch expert witness work with a 10-foot pole. I really enjoy it because I think that I'm serving a very unique purpose within the legal realm. And two, I think that it actually challenges me to be at my best, because the bar for having to always talk about, understand like what your reasoning was for making a diagnosis, like what you considered. I mean, it just has to be airtight to be an expert witness. That's hopefully a good one. Yeah. So it actually has made me, I think, a better psychologist overall. And then as I already talked about, I love working with attorneys. Like that might be not be the experience of everybody, but I enjoy it. I liked working with attorneys. So I find that part also really cool. Just being able to collaborate with a different professional who is an expertise in a different field. But I think that some of the best and then some of the things that I've seen in attorneys is oftentimes I feel like because of you guys have really stressful lives, like litigation. I mean, activity, it's so stressful. Prep is stressful. Things will just get thrown out of left field. And so sometimes I feel like attorneys call me in their biggest moment of anxiety. And then I feel like, yeah, I'm like, okay, well, this is a lot of anxious energy. And you're telling me right now that I have to write a report for you and that it's due today. Like, that's obviously not going to happen. But, you know, something happened and like, this is what's happening. So I think that as long as you kind of keep the communication open and you're able to truly collaborate, it's great. But I think that when attorneys start to get really emotional, as some of them may when they're under stress, sure. That might not be the best way to work together. And certainly it doesn't look good in the courtroom either, right? Like if an attorney is cross-examining me and they don't like what I'm saying and they're starting to like get really emotional with me and almost bully me, that gets picked up on by the jury.
Oh, of course.
And it's also just like the perception of cultural stereotypes or like, oh, she's a female and look at him. He's like this big burly man. Like he's beating up on this little girl or whatever. It's like, I mean, not that I'm the one who like tries to act in that way at all, but like juries will have those perceptions if attorneys get too emotional. And then I've seen attorneys who like just handle it with such ease, right? They're like performing. Maybe you're one of those, Evan.
Yeah, no,
like a great public speaker. And like juries like leaning in when you're cross-examining or examining. And like, that's obviously going to be a huge plus.
I think it's a skill. I think it's an art. And I think, look, you have to love being in the courtroom and the theatrics and the drama. But also, it's about reading people. And to your point, if you're an attorney and you're cross-examining, whether it's a lay witness, an expert witness, there's a certain art. There's a certain touch. There's a certain... Yeah. Rapport that you're going to have, even if you don't have a witness that's favorable to you because you have a judge or you have a jury, and it's about people and it's about emotions and understanding the players and the dynamics is so incredibly important, both as an expert and as an attorney.
It so makes sense. And I mean, I also know attorneys who say, I'm happy to do all the work before litigation, but once litigation comes up, I'm bringing in my partner, right? I'm bringing somebody who like, that's their thing, but I will do the depositions before. I will do all the records. I will do everything else. That's part of it. Filing all the motions, but I'm not going to be that person who wants to be in the courtroom. And then I meet like the litigation person that's actually going to be examining me. They're like fired up. They're like excited. Like that's their realm.
It's an adrenaline rush. That's exactly what it is. And I got to tell you, I'm going to have to get your number, put it on speed dial. We're going to be best friends. You love attorneys and you love being on the stand. So I'm going to have to get your number to be on speed dial.
Perfect. Perfect.
And Judy, I want to ask you, because you've had such a remarkable career in the courtroom, in private practice, writing books, a successful and published author. Who are your role models? And as you look back on what you've accomplished, where you are, is there a person or two that has had a positive impact on your career?
Yeah, I feel like so many people have been instrumental to me being where I am today. Mentorship is incredibly important. And during my doctoral program, I had the best dissertation mentor and also the best clinical supervisor. I mean, they both had very different styles, but they were both very nurturing, but also like had high expectations. And essentially taught me everything I know in many ways and set a great bar for how I should mentor my students. And so I feel like having those role models to emulate is so important. And then feeling like you're cared about even when you make mistakes, because obviously I did, I was in training, but still being told like, you know what, like just fix it, like fix it and don't do it again. Like it's really helpful to have that structure and to know that you can mess up sometimes, but you can also come back from that and try to do your best. And honestly, throughout my life, I've learned the most from my mistakes and my achievements, right? Because when you achieve something, when you're doing great, like people just say you're doing great and then you don't really get any feedback. It's when you make mistakes that it really causes you to self-examine and try to be better. And so I've learned to be really good with constructive criticism from that angle of like, at the end of the day, it makes me better. And like, that's even the truth for expert witness work, especially in my first few years, made lots of missteps. And now I'm just like, oh, okay. Like, don't do that anymore. Or like, this is an area of weakness in your knowledge base and you need to strengthen it. One of the earliest mistakes I made was writing attorneys long emails. And finally, an attorney called me, picked up the phone, said, please do not write this because it's all discoverable. And that's too much information. Yeah. Like, let's just talk about it. I'm like, okay. It's like, I'm like crafting these like 5-paragraph emails explaining why, you know, I made a certain decision about a plaintiff evaluation. They're like, I don't need all that. Please just call me. I'm like, okay.
Yeah. It's nowadays either with an expert, we'll have someone retained by myself or our law firm to, so essentially the work product is covered. Or in fact, look, you'll have conversations and we'll work with experts in all different capacities, whether it's a retained expert in a consulting capacity or someone is going to testify and be a rebuttal expert. But it's fascinating listening to you say that. And I want to ask you a question in terms of, you mentioned you had a newborn when you wrote the book and obviously being a parent. Does being a parent, do you look at certain situations in private practice differently? Did you look at writing this book differently in some ways as opposed to the first book because of everything that was going on at home and in terms of your own personal growth and what was happening on that front?
Yeah, I think that I just became more mindful because I had to be. I don't think that I was particularly the most mindful person before. Like, obviously I practice it. I know that it's helpful for me, but it's hard. It's hard to kind of stay in the present moment. But when you look at a child, I mean, they're going to be different from moment to moment. I mean, you can have plans and they'll just get ruined in like 1 minute because they decide that they're going to have a different day than you planned. So I had to learn to be a lot more flexible and then just to kind of like adjust as things happened. And that was like a big part of self-development for me because I never thought of myself as being like a particularly, oh, you know what, let's just see how it goes. Like, but having to exercise that part of my brain was good, I think. It's kind of nice to have that balance.
And Dr. Judy, I want to bring on producer Dave. Dave, come back on to the podcast. I want to turn it over to you for a fun segment we do on the Shine Up podcast called They Said It.
They Said It.
They Said It.
They Said It.
Yes, back for another edition of They Said It, where I provide 3 quotes from famous people, and we see what Dr. Judy thinks of them, pro, con, or otherwise. We will begin with philosopher and Dr. Albert Schweitzer. He said the following, success is not the key to happiness. Happiness is the key to success. If you love what you are doing, you will be successful. Your thoughts on that, Dr. Judy?
Oh, well, I love this quote. Because I think that people chase happiness, but they don't really know to what end. It's like, I just want to be happy. I just want to be happy. It's like, well, if you're just chasing it for the lack of the negative emotion and that you don't want to have that, then it's not really meaningful. But if you can find something that feels like it's part of your highest value system, something that you truly treasure, you're going to be happy and you're going to be successful because you're going to put more energy into it and you're not going to quit when the going gets tough. True happiness is not about the absence of negative emotion. It's more just about feeling that deep sense of purpose and meaning. And that's what I think makes people really happy.
That's a terrific answer. I agree. And I'm always reminded of what Ben and Jerry, the ice cream guy, said is, if it's not fun, why do it? But you know what? Yeah. Easy for them to say. Their whole life is
ice cream. Yeah, they make ice cream.
Yeah, we can't
all make
ice cream.
They're not living in real life.
Exactly. We can all eat ice cream. Second quote comes to us from author and Dr. Rachel Naomi Remen. She said the following, healing may not be so much about getting better as about letting go of everything that isn't you, all the expectations, all the beliefs, and becoming who you are. Your thoughts on that one?
Yeah, interesting. I mean, I think healing, it's this idea of healing, like I'm all better. No, I think we're always evolving and there's always self-development, right? So this idea of healing maybe isn't like, okay, I've gotten to healing, like I ran my marathon and now I can be done with it and check it off. It's a process. But I think the healing process can be expedited and improved upon if you're not thinking about all the time who you're supposed to be and just really getting connected with who you are at the core. Like what does it mean if there's nobody else around and people's opinions didn't matter so much to me? Like, what do I really want? And how do I really see myself? That's really hard to do though. Like, I love this statement but it's probably hard for people probably to translate it. Like, what does that really mean? Like, I don't know how many people, I don't know how many people are actually asking themselves that question anymore, because it's so easy just to get so mixed up with what everybody else wants from you.
Yeah, I don't know if this is a perfect comparison, but I think of a tortured baseball example, and that is that the best hitters are often the ones who are just thinking about the pitch they're about to see and not about the fact that they're 0-for-8 and on the verge of being benched, which is why, Evan, you'll appreciate it. I always thought batters like Johnny Damon and Manny Ramirez were so good because they just weren't thinking about a whole lot. There wasn't a lot going on upstairs except hit the baseball. But it's hard for many of us to let go. Again, tortured comparison. And with that in mind, let's move on to our third quote. Comes to us from Pablo Picasso, who said the following. When he said it, it was probably in Italian and it sounded fancier. But nevertheless, Pablo said the following. Every child is an artist. The problem is how to remain an artist once we grow up. And Dr. Judy, I know you'll perhaps read more into it than we're not just talking about painters and sculptors here. But at any rate, your thoughts on that quote.
I love it. Yeah. I think that children are the most creative and the most expressive because they have not yet understood like what it's like to be shut down or just to be told that it's not okay to express yourself in this way. Until we're an adult, then we kind of rein all that in because we think that there's certain ways that we should be behaving as an adult. And that actually takes us away from more creative processes, being able to brainstorm more interesting solutions that are actually going to work. We tend to kind of stick with what we know, and then we're kind of bound by and confined by societal expectations. I saw this really interesting experiment where they basically put common objects together and they just said, what does this look like? Right. And as an adult, most adults would say, okay, that looks like chopsticks, like laid across a napkin. But like when you ask children, like they came up with the most cool answers. It was like, that's a sunset, or like, that's a ladder and they're going up to a house in the sky. I mean, so it was just so amazing to kind of see how kids responded to that versus how adults did. So this really reminds me of that experiment and how we could all use a little bit more of that sense of awe and wonder when we get older.
From the mouth of babes. Yeah. I have a son who is, he's an adult, but he has autism. So developmentally, he still has some childlike qualities. And he said to me once, a joke is like a mistake. And I didn't think much of it at the time. And then I went back and then I realized what he was saying. And there's some wisdom in that. When you're crafting a joke, you want to zing someone with the unexpected. So he's saying, if you make a mistake, that's what's funny. That's
right.
So I try to learn from him, but thank you. Thank you, Pablo Picasso. And thank you, Dr. Judy. Excellent job on They Said It. And back to you, Evan.
And Dave, great job as always. Where else could you talk about attachment theories and Pablo Picasso and give a great baseball analogy other than the Shine Up podcast? And Dr. Judy, this was absolutely fantastic. Your two books, The New Rules of Attachment and Stop the Self-Sabotage, two great books. Tell everybody who's listening where they can pick up copies of the books, get in touch, and find out all the wonderful things that you're doing.
Well, thanks so much for the great conversation. And you can find more about me on social media at Dr. Judy Ho. My Instagram account is my most primary handle, although I have accounts throughout all of the different social media platforms also. And then you can find free resources and sign up for my newsletter at drjudyho.com.
Thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thank you so much, Evan. Thanks, David.
Episode 75 of the Shine On Podcast. Dr. Judy Ho was brilliant. Her books, The New Rules of Attachment and Self-Sabotage, are tremendous. Producer Dave, what an episode on the 75th episode of the Shine On Podcast.
Congratulations to you, Evan. 75, no small feat. On the way to 7,500 one day.
That's right. And thank you to you, Dave. And thank you to all the listeners who can listen to the podcast wherever you get your podcast. I'm Evan Shine, and I'll talk to you again real soon.